One of the things about Malcolm that continues to fascinate people all over the world are the dramatic events that occurred leading up to his death. Let's talk for a few minutes about the assassination and its aftermath. I'd like to set the scene. It's February 21st, 1965. It is a clear and sunny day in New York City. Herman Ferguson, a young assistant principal in the New York public school system, drives from his Queens home, and he arrives in Upper Manhattan, and today in a neighborhood called Washington Heights, then generally referred to as Harlem, but that's another discussion. He arrives at West 166th Street at the corner of Broadway. Now, Ferguson is a leading member of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which had been sponsoring a series of public forums in the Audubon Ballroom at this location. The key speaker that day is supposed to be Reverend Milton Galamison, who's a prominent civil rights activist. He's very involved in the desegregation efforts in New York City. Now, as Ferguson drives past the building, he notices something a little unusual. When you drive past on West 166, across from the entrance at the Audubon is a triangular park that the locals, folks living in the neighborhood, refer to as Pigeon Park, because there are hundreds and hundreds of pigeons there. Usually, at the OAAU-sponsored events, the NYPD stations at least a dozen police officers in the front of the building. This day, as he's driving by, he only sees one officer. He drives by, parks his car, and he comes back. And then he looks across the street again, and he sees that that officer is gone. Now, Ferguson walks into the entrance and he goes up the steps of the Audubon's main auditorium. A few people are already sitting in the auditorium. Other people have told us that a group of three or perhaps four men are already sitting on the front row. It's winter, and so people are still wearing heavy coats, even inside. No police are in the auditorium whatsoever, which is, again, very unusual. Ferguson noticed several men in different parts of the auditorium who are supposed to provide security, but he doesn't recognize who they are. And so this is also another kind of curious thing. Ferguson himself, several weeks earlier, had been asked to provide security for an OAAU rally. But the turnover of the personnel in the group means that on this particular day, he doesn't recognize any of the people providing security. Within a couple hours, about 300, maybe 400 people have arrived. The program is supposed to start at 2 o'clock. It's now about 3:10. The speaker has not yet arrived. And as things would occur, Galamison's secretary phones James Shabazz, or James 67X, who is one of the key figures, the personnel, in running the program, and tells James that, that Reverend Galamison is not going to appear at the program. People huddle in the back. They decide, let's go ahead and do the program anyway. So finally, about an hour late, the group's leader walks out from the backstage to the center of the platform, and he's greeted with enthusiastic applause. To his family and his friends, the leader is known as El Haj Malik El Shabazz, but to the rest of the world, he's known as Malcolm X. The audience applause dies down. Malcolm X extends his greetings both to his friends and his enemies in attendance, when suddenly a disruption occurs. It's about a third of the way back in the auditorium. Someone says, "Take your hands out of my pocket." The two men begin to scuffle. All eyes turn around to the center of the disturbance. The security men, who have been positioned throughout the auditorium, leave their sights and begin to go toward the site of the conflict. Malcolm says, hold it, don't get excited. Let's cool it, brothers. It's only then that Malcolm noticed at least two or three men sitting on the front row who quickly make their move toward the speaker's podium. The man carrying the shotgun, crooked in his arm, probably fires first, about 15 feet away. The shot hits Malcolm dead center in his chest and his heart. Malcolm fell backward, crashing to the stage. The other gunmen rush up with 45 and 38 caliber handguns. The medical examiner later says that at least 13 separate wounds are counted in his heart, his chest, and wounds pockmark his thighs and his legs. The middle part of his finger on his left hand, the middle finger on his left hand, the top of it has been blown away with a bullet. Blood is gushing out of his face, his goatee. In the chaotic scene that occurs, all but one of the gunmen managed to escape. Talmadge Hare, 22 years old, has been wounded in the left leg. Reuben Francis, one of the OAAU security personnel, is the only OAAU member who was wearing arms that day. And that's a point we'll come back to. He pulls his gun and he shoots and he hits Hare. But all the others manage to escape. Hare tumbles down the steps and an angry crowd surrounds the guy and probably would have beaten him to death had not the NYPD stopped in front of the building, grab Hare, and put him in the car. What the crowd doesn't know is that this NYPD police squad car had not been called to go to the assassination to find out what the disturbance was. It was just accidentally driving by. Where are the police? The police and the mainstream press immediately characterized Malcolm's murder as the result of a feud between two black nationalist sects. The OAAU, led by Malcolm X, and the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, two groups that Malcolm founded in 1964, versus the Nation of Islam, headed by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. The public break that Malcolm initiated in March of 1964 has generally rated a series of violent confrontations between the two groups, which the media generally characterizes as these two factions of the quote-unquote black Muslims. Only a week prior to the public slaying, Malcolm's family home in Elmhurst section of Queens had been firebombed with Molotov cocktails. Following Malcolm's murder, a fire was set at the Nation of Islam's Muslim Mosque, Harlem Mosque No. 7, with extensive damage. And following that, the OAAU offices in the Hotel Teresa in Central Harlem were ransacked. Now, the question is, who is doing this? The media's interpretation is the two groups are doing it to each other. Now, most mainstream black leaders took extreme pains to separate themselves from Malcolm, from the murder, and from the feud. Carl Rowan, who was the director of the U.S. Information Agency at the time, about a day or two after Malcolm's death, but prior to the funeral, gave a speech where he talked about Malcolm X. He denounced Malcolm as a, quote, a Negro who preached segregation and race hatred, an ex-convict, ex-dope peddler, who became a racial fanatic, unquote. Adam Clayton Powell Jr., the congressman from Harlem, the head of the prestigious Abyssinia Baptist Church, tried to get his board of trustees to agree to having the funeral at Abyssinian. The board of trustees refused. Other churches also refused. A small church in Harlem did agree, the Faith Temple Church, headed up by the Reverend Alvin Childs, to permit the funeral to occur. And there were threats of, constant threats, that violence was going to outbreak around the funeral. The prominent actor, Ossie Davis, was asked by the family and the friends of Malcolm to deliver the eulogy. Now, many people told Ossie this was not a good idea, that violence was going to break out. But nevertheless, Ossie sat down at his kitchen table and drafted out the eulogy, and the next day attended the funeral with his wife, actress Ruby Dee. And these were the words that Ossie said. Many were asked what Harlem finds to honor in this stormy, controversial young captain. And we will smile. They will say that he is of hate, a fanatic, a racist. And we will answer, did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did you ever touch him or have him talk to you? Did you ever really listen to him? Did he ever do a mean thing? Was he ever himself associated with violence or any public disturbance? For if you did, you would know him. Malcolm was our manhood. This was his meaning to our people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. And we will know him then for what he was and is, a prince, our own black shining prince, who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so. The words and the image of the black shining prince frame Malcolm from that moment to this day. Now, immediately following Malcolm's murder and the funeral, there was intense speculation in the press about the parties who were responsible. The public was not informed that the NYPD, the New York Police Department, had planted agents both within the Nation of Islam and Muslim Mosque Incorporated and the OAAU. Indeed, there could have been as many as 20 agents out of the 300 to 400 people in the audience at the Audubon Ballroom when Malcolm was killed that afternoon. No public inquiries were launched following the murder, the assassination, whether the NYPD or the Federal Bureau of Investigation had prior knowledge of the assassination, or in any way helped to facilitate or participate in the shooting. Only one of the murderers, Talmadge Hare, actually was arrested at the crime scene. And it was not until February the 26th, 1965, that Norman 3X Butler and a third man, Thomas 15X Johnson, both former Nation of Islam members, were charged and arrested and then charged with a murder. Hare would later admit that he alone purchased one of the guns, including a 12-gauge shotgun, used in the murder. And although Butler and Johnson steadfastly denied their involvement, in fact, they both said they were not even in the Audubon that day, Hare's implication of them virtually guaranteed that they would be declared guilty. All three were sentenced to life in prison. And as far as the criminal justice system was concerned, the matter was over, and the murders had been solved. All right, a decade goes by. In late 1977, Hare confesses to his prison chaplain, a Muslim minister, that Butler and Johnson were not involved in the murder in any way. Butler and Johnson's attorney, on the strength of this, radical attorney William Kunstler takes up the case and demands it that it be reopened. in part trying to get to the questions that I'm posing today. Who was actually involved in the murder? Now, Kunstler pushes this issue. He appeals for a new trial. The appeal is summarily dismissed by New York Judge Harold Rathway, who rules that there was insufficient evidence to warrant a trial. Now, the following year, Kunstler petitions to the U.S. House of Representatives to hold a special inquiry into the possible role of the FBI and other federal agents in Malcolm X's assassination. Despite the strong support of the Congressional Black Caucus, no hearing is held in Congress, and Kunstler's efforts lead nowhere. Now, all of this raises many questions for the historian. First, even a superficial review of the forensic evidence and the case file reveals on Malcolm X's assassination reveals some serious questions. First, in his epilogue, in the autobiography of Malcolm X, Alex Haley observes, and I quote here, that although police sources said that a special detail of 20 men had been assigned to the meeting and that had even been attending, the meeting was attended by agents of the Bureau of Special Services. These men were nowhere in evidence during or after the shooting, the assassination. The police officers who had, as I said, stopped at their squad car at the entrance of the Audubon, who had captured the wounded Hare, had not actually been called to the crime scene. Minutes went by, no ambulance arrived, and yet fewer than 300 yards away, one of the largest and most prestigious hospitals in the United States exists, Columbia Presbyterian. Why did no one from the hospital respond? Desperately, the men in the audience ran to the hospital to grab a stretcher, bring the stretcher to the Audubon Ballroom, place Malcolm in it, and carry him physically on the ground, literally, to the hospital for him to be looked at by surgeons. Now, this is an unbelievable situation, and yet this is exactly what occurs. We later find out that Malcolm's bodyguard, one of his bodyguards, Gene Roberts, who gives him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, there's a photo of it, is actually an NYPD special agent, paid agent, New York Police Department, Bureau of Special Services, which is called BOSS. Malcolm's security forces, many of Malcolm's security forces had left the Nation of Islam and had been members of the Nation of Islam in 1964. It is possible that some members of the Nation of Islam who had been loyal to Elijah Muhammad defected with Malcolm with the intention of being double agents, finding out information inside of the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, which Malcolm created, to report back to the Nation of Islam. Max Stanford, the co-founder of the Revolutionary Action Movement, who we interviewed as a part of the Malcolm X research project, believes that the NOI did not murder Malcolm X, but that its leader, Elijah Muhammad, was paid, as he put it, quote, to stay out of it. He knew beforehand that the assassination was going to happen, unquote. But Stanford also suggests that just prior to the assassination, that Malcolm's personal life was in disarray. There were rumors that circulated within the OAAU and the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. There were tensions between these two organizations. The OAAU attracted people who had never been in the Nation of Islam. It was a secular organization. Black nationalists and activists new to politics. Many of these people distrusted and did not share the views of the former Muslims who were in the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. There were tensions between the various leaders and the factions of the two organizations. Stanford states plainly, quote, some of Malcolm X's own men killed Malcolm, who had been previously in the Fruit of Islam, unquote. Now, what are we to think of Stanford's assertion? Max Stanford's thesis appears to be supported by eyewitness testimony that is recounted in a book by James Farmer, his autobiography, Lay Bare My Heart. And the account goes this way. Farmer's, in his autobiography, the account identifies three gunmen, two who had pistols who fired from a crouched position in front of the platform, and a third man, presumably Hare, firing what Farmer recounts from an eyewitness to the event as, quote, firing with a sawed-off shotgun from the wing of the stage, unquote. From the wing of the stage. This eyewitness states that the two men with pistols then pocketed the weapons and ran out unobstructed. Now, who are we to believe? Stanford's claims of conspiracy, an internal conspiracy, are discounted roundly by anyone who had a relationship, an intimate relationship, with Malcolm X. Nevertheless, they are out here. However, there were, and also keep in mind, Stanford did not witness the assassination. He's getting this information secondhand. However, there were deep and serious tensions between members, as I said, of the two organizations. According to James 67X, now Abdullah Abdur Razak, let's call him Brother Razak. That's, keep in mind, James Shabazz, James 67X, and Razak are all the same individual. Okay. What does Razak say? Razak says that Muslim mosque members were, quote, the only ones who could have done anything. Razak was highly critical of the OAAU's female leadership, and specifically the authority Malcolm had bestowed upon a young woman journalist, Lynn Shiflett, throughout most of 1964. Indeed, as other people have told us, and they were not forthcoming with this. In fact, you will not see, I don't believe, Lynn Shiflett's name in the autobiography of Malcolm X. Nevertheless, she is a critical person in the organization and development and leadership of the OAAU. Razak and Shiflett did not see eye to eye on the running of these organizations. One incident that triggered a conflict was around the call to create rifle clubs or gun clubs. Razak states, quote, and so the brothers stood arming themselves. They were walking around all around Harlem with their carbines. When several were arrested briefly and jailed and then were released, they immediately, quote, went to the OAAU meeting and tried to gain admittance, Razak states. And they were told that they could not get in because their dues weren't paid. Oh, God, Razak exclaims. Quote, they came and told me that they were going to overthrow and get all these women out of here. Razak was so frustrated that he actually quit two or three times for several days, only to be convinced by Malcolm to rejoin the movement. And so clearly gender, which we will talk about later, gender had a tension, had a part of the whole tension between Malcolm and what was occurring. Now, the tensions between Razak and Malcolm openly erupted at the Audubon only minutes before the assassination. When Razak learned that Galamison was not going to be speaking, he phoned Malcolm's home and he got Betty Shabazz on the phone, Malcolm's wife, and he informed Betty that Galamison was not going to be appearing that day and that she should inform her husband. Now, two things. Number one, Betty rarely attended OAAU functions. And this was also a source of tension between Betty and her perception of some of the female leadership of the OAAU. A second problem is, perhaps, tensions between Betty and Malcolm. Malcolm comes in and he finds out that Razak has pwned his home, and he blows up. Razak describes it to us. He becomes furious and he says, "Why did you phone? Why did you not tell me?" And Razak says, "Because I didn't know where you were." And indeed, Malcolm frequently slept in a variety of places, in part as a security measure every night. And so these tensions are building between Razak and Malcolm as Malcolm goes out on the stage. How did Malcolm X attract FBI attention? Well, while he was still incarcerated, you have to go back many years. In the early 1950s, in April 1950, Malcolm had been reassigned to Charleston Prison in Massachusetts, which is one of the worst prisons in the Massachusetts penal system. Within weeks of his transfer, he and two other prisoners demand being placed in cells that faced east, which would allow them to pray to Mecca. This small item gets covered in the local newspapers. And it's here that you see the construction and the beginning of the interest in the FBI in this black Muslim. Now, Malcolm was released from prison in August 1952. He immediately relocates to Detroit. He's living with his brother Wilfred, but he neglects to register for the draft as the law requires. So on February the 17th, 1953, an FBI agent interviews Malcolm about his failure to register for the draft, and he does so 3 days later. However, within less than a year, Malcolm's draft classification is downgraded from 1A to 4F, making him ineligible for military service. It did not take long before the Bureau began to assign agents to conduct covert operations to monitor what Malcolm was saying and doing. Now, this is quite remarkable because Malcolm has just joined the NOI. He is not a well-known public speaker. He's not a public leader of the NOI. And yet, the FBI, on January the 8th, 1954, attends a meeting, at least an agent does, in a modest home in Boston, Massachusetts, where Malcolm is attempting to found or initiate the mosque for the Nation of Islam, Temple Number 11. The agent notes in his report that Malcolm had urged, quote, that the Muslims recruit younger members. Later in that same month, the FBI observes that Malcolm has also attended organizing meetings at New York's Small Temple Number 7. On February 1954, the Chicago office of the FBI carefully notes when Minister Malcolm X led an informal tour of black Muslims through the Field Museum of Natural History. Somehow, something they saw in the Field Museum was deemed to be subversive. Finally, the FBI decides to confront the subject head on. January the 10th, 1955, is the first in-depth, detailed interview that the FBI has with Malcolm X. It would not be the last. And according to their records, this interview did not go well. According to the FBI records, Malcolm strongly denied even being a minister and claimed no formal affiliation with the Boston, Philadelphia, or Detroit Muslim temples. When the FBI asked about the Nation of Islam's, quote, racial hatred policies, unquote, Malcolm reportedly shot back that Muslims, quote, do not teach hatred, but the truth. The black man that has been enslaved in the United States by the white man, and that no one could dispute it. Now, Malcolm refuses to answer whether he would serve in the armed forces. Now, supposedly this issue has already been decided the year before, or defend the United States if it came under attack. He did, however, admit in the interview with the FBI that, quote, he admired, unquote, the Japanese people during World War II, and even, quote, would have liked to have joined the Japanese army at that time. Now, Malcolm was having a little joke at the FBI's expense. I don't think the FBI got the sense of humor. So there is an escalation of coverage of Malcolm, and the file begins to grow. January the 28th, 1955, the FBI begins to regularly monitor Malcolm X's speeches and sermons, recording and transcribing direct quotations in considerable detail. The FBI's January 1955 file quotes Malcolm's talks or statements praising the Mau Mau revolt that then was being waged in Kenya, in East Africa. It also includes his views that he is sympathetic to the struggles for liberation in, quote, the war in Indochina. Now keep in mind, this is January 1955. The only American advisors on the ground are the CIA. And yet Malcolm is already identified as a flashpoint, what later would become the Vietnam War, and expressed his opposition to it in 1955. So the FBI takes strong interest in him. Let's move to 1957. Eisenhower administration's attorney general, Herbert Brownell, authorizes the wiretapping of Elijah Muhammad's personal telephone. Historian David Garrow claims that by the late 50s, the FBI has constructed what is called COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. COINTELPRO. It was carrying out dirty tricks against the Nation of Islam. Agents were sent to record NOI-sponsored events. Nation of Islam members were brought in for questioning or other forms of harassment. Malcolm rose in public prominence during the late 50s, and so the FBI's coverage of him accelerates. Now, here's the question. How involved was the Nation of Islam in the assassination? Prominent NOI leaders made no secret of their hatred of Malcolm X. Perhaps the angriest critic of Malcolm was the man who had been his protege and his closest friend, Louis X, the minister of Boston's Temple No. 11. We know him today as Louis Farrakhan. Louis Farrakhan, or Louis X, in December the 4th, 1964, in the edition of Muhammad Speaks newspaper, Louis X warns his former mentor that he, quote, shall not escape. Malcolm X was a man who richly, quote, deserves death, unquote. On January the 15th, 1965, only 5 weeks before Malcolm's assassination, Muhammad Speaks depicts a cartoon of Malcolm X's severed head bouncing down the road beside gravestones marked with the names Benedict Arnold, Judas, and others. The grisly cartoon was featured above an article by NOI Minister Filbert X, Malcolm's brother, Filbert Little, who strongly denounced Malcolm. Researcher Carl Evans has discovered evidence that places NOI National Security National Secretary John Ali, one of Malcolm's chief critics within the Nation of Islam, in New York City, meeting Hayer 2 days before the murder. Was Ali here in New York prior to the murder? What was the role of the NOI? Now, the NOI, the FBI, and the New York Police Department certainly had the capacity to know about these arrangements in preparations for the assassination. They certainly knew, and this is true, that the members who carried out the assassination actually went to the Audubon, according to Hayer's evidence, members from New Jersey, and did a walkthrough of the assassination a week prior to the murder. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I do know something about capital cases and law, that if a federal or a state agency or a local agency has knowledge, prior knowledge of a murder before it is committed, they are legally bound as law enforcement officers to make people aware of this or to stop the event. The same kind of situation arose during the civil rights movement with Viola Luiso, a Michigan housewife who was murdered in Alabama in the mid-1960s. What did the FBI know and when did it know it? What did the NYPD know and when did it know it? And then finally, what we have found in the project is that Malcolm, in many real ways, Malcolm's assassination, in fact, the piece of evidence that is most astonishing about the assassination, it was generated by the project. A very lengthy interview we had with Herman Ferguson. Ferguson's eyewitness account is absolutely remarkable and very detailed. As Malcolm stepped to the front of the podium on the edge of the stage, Ferguson says, quote, "There was a loud blast, a boom, that filled the entire auditorium with the sound of a weapon going off." He continues, "Malcolm straightened up for a moment like this. His hand came in front and stiffened. The shotgun blast that had been fired at him by one of the assassins who fired from the crook of his elbow, he hit Malcolm point blank in his left chest that was shot, and then a fusillage of shots rang out. This kept going for several seconds. And I remember saying that if they could just stop firing, that maybe he could survive this. And when they did, Malcolm toppled over backwards, and the back of his head hit the floor with a crash." Ferguson then goes on, and he says that he is one of the few people in the auditorium that day to stand, literally to stand, he was seated, but he watched the assassination point blank. Nearly everybody else got on the floor to stay out of the line of fire. The assassins noted Ferguson, but he noted him. And there were two things that he noticed. One, that in the background he noticed a series of lights emanating from behind the curtain. Ferguson wasn't sure, but it seemed as if someone was taking, with a camera, was taking a film of the hit. These lights look like a camera lights. Second thing that he noticed is that he's not sure about this and offers contradictory testimony, but Ferguson believes that there were four, not three shooters. Hayer's later description to Peter Goldman says that there were five men involved. There's a driver and four others. How many people were actually involved in the murder? One more fact to keep in mind before people answer the question, who killed Malcolm X? We're the jury today, okay? One more fact. When Malcolm was killed at 3:10, 3:15 in the afternoon, the police are all reported, by all reports we have, were very lackadaisical at best in responding to the assassination. Cops were standing around, they were talking. The crime scene is blocked off. Basic procedure by the NYPD, by any police department in the world, is to look for bullets, forensic evidence. There's a crime scene here. Within four hours, the crime scene being blocked off is taken away. People come out with buckets of water and mop up Malcolm's blood. And at 7 o'clock, a dance is held at the Audubon Ballroom, a dance. Now, here's the question. Why this cavalier at best, and that's a generous description, a cavalier approach to toward investigating the murder of a prominent American. There's no way you could do this, the search of the for the bullets, obtaining the forensic evidence that you need to have in order to make a case. Why did the police act this way? What did they know, and what and why would they not investigate? The only reason I can guess is that they knew it was going to occur. Whether they committed it or not remains to be actually resolved. But keep in mind, class, there is no statute of limitations on murder. Now, let me add two other facts for you to consider. One, that after the firebombing of Malcolm's home on Sunday night, a week before he would be murdered, he tucked his family away, made sure that they were safe, but gave strict orders that at the next rally at the Audubon, no one would be searched entering the ballroom. And two, none of his guards would be carrying weapons. Why did Malcolm do this? Did he want to die? What do you think? There is some doubt about this. People we have talked with who were close to Malcolm tell us that the reason that he did not want people to be frisked or checked for weapons at the Audubon is that he wanted to try to reach more of a black middle class crowd, and that this is a turnoff for people. So that by not frisking people, they always frisk people inside of the NOI. The old procedure Malcolm wanted to get away from, so people would feel comfortable and not intimidated. So that was one of the reasons. But the second question of his guards not carrying weapons, that was the new element. And Ferguson and others tell us that the men vociferously opposed Malcolm. And we asked him, didn't any of you just overrule Malcolm? And James 67X, James Razak says, you didn't know Malcolm. Malcolm was headstrong, and there was no one in either of the organizations who could order Malcolm and tell him to do something he didn't want to do. We know that the police did carry out an investigation of the murder. We have recently found, our graduate students have found in on Center Street in the basement of the city archive the actual notebooks of the police as they interviewed people. We have the police accounts of interviewing people at the crimes after the crime scene. So increasingly we're collecting more evidence and we're trying to put together the story. But there are some things that we're not going to find out until we go through the FBI material in the National Archives. There are over 20,000 pages of documents. Only about a fourth of that material is available online. The other three-fourths, 15,000 pages, we're going to have to plow through. And perhaps someplace the FBI will not have blacked out information. It's very much like a Rashomon story where everybody sees something and they have a particular point of view and they tell us a tale. We're trying to unravel the stories and find out the common elements of truth that undergird the story, because even in a lie, there are elements of the truth that make it convincing. That's what we have to figure out.